Which is the most persecuted religious group in the world today? The answer, in terms of sheer numbers and sheer horror, might surprise you. It's Christians, specifically Christians living in Muslim-majority countries, countries where Christians often preceded Muslims by centuries. I'm not talking about war on Christmas type harassment. I'm talking about know your place or we're going to kill you persecution. Astonishingly, the Western mainstream media barely acknowledge what is happening. Let's look closer at this issue. It tells us a lot about the world we're living in. 100 years ago, 20% of North Africa and the Middle East, the birthplace of Christianity, was Christian. Today, Christians make up 4% of the population. Much of that decline has occurred in the last decade. In essence, Muslims are rendering North Africa and the Middle East free of Christians. Take Egypt, for example, my ancestral homeland. In just the past 2 years, tens of thousands of Christian Copts have left Egypt. And many others want to leave, but they simply cannot afford to. Why they want to leave is no mystery. On New Year's Day, 2011, the Two Saints Church in Alexandria was bombed, leaving 23 Copts dead and 97 injured. In recent years, dozens of Coptic churches have been attacked, many burned to the ground. In August 2013 alone, the Muslim Brotherhood and its supporters attacked and destroyed some 80 churches. Unfortunately, Egypt is more the rule than the exception. Hundreds of Nigerian churches have been destroyed in recent years, with especially deadly attacks reserved for Christmas and Easter church services, leaving dozens dead or mutilated. Churches have been bombed or burned in Iraq, Syria, and just about every place in the Middle East where churches still exist, except Israel. Christian businesses have been torched, Christian girls have been kidnapped, sold as child brides or slaves, and had acid thrown in their faces for not being veiled. Anyone born a Muslim who converts to Christianity faces jail and possibly execution. The list of fresh atrocities by Muslims against Christians grows longer almost every day. Even in Muslim countries often portrayed as moderate, Morocco, Indonesia, Malaysia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Christian minorities are under legal pressure not to build churches or evangelize. The Christians in these Muslim countries are often identical to their co-citizens in race, ethnicity, national identity, culture, and language. There is no political dispute between the Christians and Muslims, no land dispute. Vastly outnumbered and politically marginalized, these Christians simply wish to worship in peace. Instead, they are hounded and attacked. So then, why is this happening? And why is the media making so little mention of it? The first question is easy to answer. Christians are being persecuted in Muslim countries because they're Christians, or as the Quran puts it, infidels. That is, non-Muslims who are regarded by many fundamentalist Muslims as inferior. As a fundamentalist interpretation of the holy books of Islam has grown in the last 50 or so years, Christians have suffered, and in recent years they have suffered terribly. I document this in my book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. If this were happening to any other group besides Christians, it would be the human rights tragedy of our time. There would be loud worldwide calls for action. But the silence in the mainstream Western media is, as they say, almost deafening. Why? Because Muslim persecution of Christians throws a wrench in the media's narrative that Muslim violence is a product of Muslim grievance. That grievance is, first and foremost, portrayed as the sin of European colonialism and alleged American imperialism. In the Muslim world's mind, those two sins are personified by the Jewish state of Israel, a nation the Muslim world believes was forced upon it by the colonial powers of Europe following World War II and is currently supported by the United States. Much of the Western world and the Western media have largely bought at least some of this narrative. Here's how it works. Because Israel, with the backing of the United States, is stronger than its Muslim neighbors, the media, while not defending Islamic terrorism, often portray terror against Israel, America, and even Europe as the actions of understandably angry underdogs fighting for what they deem justice. But what happens to this media narrative when Islamic terror is directed against a minority weaker than them, in this case the millions of indigenous Christians throughout the Islamic world? The answer is that, rather than abandon this narrative, the media just don't report Muslim persecution of Christians, except for the most sensational cases. That's why you probably don't know that there are barely any Christians living in Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, nations where Christianity once thrived, or that this is happening in Egypt, Iraq, Iran, and even Lebanon. So yes, Christians are indeed the most persecuted religious group in the world today. But reporting it would violate the media's narrative of Christians as persecutors and Muslims as victims. I'm Raymond Ibrahim, author of the Al-Qaeda Reader for Prager University.
Join Prager University, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and sign up for free at PragerU.com.
Hardly a day goes by that someone of prominence, a politician, a talk show host, an entertainer, doesn't call some conservative or conservatives generally, racist. Here are typical examples. The chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Congressman Steve Israel. To a significant extent, conservatives are animated by racism. TV newscaster Ed Schultz. This is what the Republican Party stands for. Racism. Oprah Winfrey. There's a level of disrespect for the office that occurs in some cases, and maybe even many cases, because the president is African American. There's no question about that. To call someone a racist should be a very serious matter. A racist is a person who believes that one race is inherently superior or inferior to another. It's not intelligence or goodness that determines an individual's worth. It's his or her skin color. To say that racism is foolish and stupid, not to mention evil, is to understate the case. But according to many of their critics, conservatives are that stupid and that evil. But with few exceptions, conservatives are neither. So why is the charge even made? The answer is primarily political, to maintain black support for liberals and liberal policies. To back up this charge, the accusers point to conservative policies. So let's examine some conservative policies to see if they are, indeed, racist. The longstanding conservative opposition to affirmative action is a good place to start. It was Democratic President John F. Kennedy who first used the term affirmative action in 1961. But affirmative action, in the way we think of it now, wasn't implemented until 1970, during the administration of a Republican president, Richard Nixon. The theory was that, because of historical discrimination, blacks were at a competitive disadvantage to other races and ethnicities. To erase that disadvantage, standards that most blacks presumably couldn't meet had to be lowered. One could make the case that this policy had some utility when it was first put in place, but that was a long time ago. The conservative position is that blacks have repeatedly proven they can compete with anyone without the benefits, demeaning benefits, I might add, of lower standards. There are countless examples of black success in every field at every level. The policy is no longer necessary. But the conservative argument goes further. Study after study shows that, in the case of college admissions, affirmative action actually hurts many blacks. By lowering admission standards for blacks and some other minority students, colleges set many of these students up for failure. They get placed in schools for which they're not prepared. And high black dropout rates confirm this view. So does common sense. If white students with mediocre SAT scores were admitted to Ivy League schools, they too would be set up to fail. Let's do the math. Conservatives believe that blacks and other minorities are every bit as capable as whites of succeeding as policemen, firemen, businessmen, lawyers, doctors, politicians, and college students. Yet for this belief, conservatives are called racist. The irony, of course, is that those who accuse conservatives of being racist believe that blacks and other minorities are not as capable as whites of succeeding and therefore still need affirmative action, almost a half century after it was first implemented. Let's look at another issue where this contrast between conservatives and those who accuse them of being racist is even more starkly drawn. Voter ID. Conservatives say that America should require that every voter present an ID when he or she votes, just as European countries do in order to help keep their elections honest. Are all these democracies racist? Of course not. Yet the accusers say that conservatives who support voter ID are racist. Why do they say this? Because, they argue, it's really a ruse to prevent blacks and other minorities from voting, since many of them just aren't capable of acquiring an ID. Can you get more condescending than that? Let's be real. You need an ID to drive, to fly, to buy a beer, even to purchase some cold medicines. Whites can do it, but blacks can't? Tell me who the races are again? One more example. It's conservatives who push for school vouchers, which would allow all parents, not just wealthy ones, to choose their children's school. It's the other side that doesn't trust minority parents to select an appropriate school for their children. Why aren't the people who compel black children to stay in terrible schools the racists? At some point, maybe you'll start asking yourself, like I did, who's really obsessed with race? And whose policies really hurt blacks and minorities? Maybe it's not who you think it is. I'm Derek Green of Project 21 for Prager University.
There is a widespread allegation, really a slander, that Israel is an apartheid state. That notion is simply wrong. It is inaccurate and it is malicious. And it will not help to promote peace and harmony in the Middle East. Its only purpose is to demonize Israel and to isolate her in an attempt to delegitimize Israel's existence. And because it is so inaccurate, it betrays the memory of those who suffered through a real apartheid. As a black South African who was born under apartheid in the administrative capital of South Africa, Pretoria, I know what apartheid is. I've experienced it. My parents experienced it. But having been to Israel on a number of occasions, I know that nothing is happening in that country that I've either seen or read that can be compared to apartheid in South Africa. Let's remember the major reason Nelson Mandela went to prison, why he was involved with the armed struggle. He was fighting for the right to vote, for the right to choose the leaders who believes in, for the right to move and travel freely, to live wherever one wants, to be educated, and to be admitted to the hospital or medical facility of your choice. All these things Mandela fought for because black people never enjoyed any of them in their very own country. For example, when I had to see a white doctor who was prepared to have black patients, I would have to go to a back room, a specially segregated room where black patients of white doctors went. We could never enter through the same door that was used by white people. Now compare that to Israel. A few years ago, a black pastor friend of mine went to Israel where he had an accident and had to be hospitalized. When he came back to South Africa, he said to as many people as he could that the people who are talking about apartheid in Israel are talking nonsense. When I was in that hospital in Israel, he tells people, on my right was sleeping a Jew, and on my left was a Palestinian Muslim. And in between that Palestinian Muslim and that Jew was this black South African. In private, the Palestinians he was with in the hospital said to him, "This Israel is an apartheid state thing, is what politicians are saying. It is not what we are experiencing on the ground." We all need to recognize that those who say that what is happening in Israel is like apartheid South Africa are minimizing the suffering that black South Africans endured. They are taking the sting out of the pain that we suffered in South Africa. If South African apartheid was what people are seeing in Israel, there would never have been any need for an armed struggle. There would never have been any need for a Nelson Mandela to go to prison because he would have all the rights Arabs in Israel have. There are judges in the Israel courts who are not Jewish in apartheid South Africa. You could never have had something like that. You have teachers who are not Jewish, who are teaching Jewish children. These non-Jews in Israel have everything that we non-whites in apartheid South Africa never shared with white South Africans. Most South Africans know this. They know that to call Israel an apartheid state is false, that what we suffered in South Africa is not being suffered by anybody in Israel. But to those South Africans who believe these falsehoods about Israel, we say, go to Israel. Go and see for yourself. Tell us where you see Palestinians having to endure what we endured during apartheid. As a member of the South African Parliament, and in the name of millions of my fellow black citizens of that country, we know what apartheid really was. And I therefore ask those in the United States, Europe, and anywhere else in the world who charge Israel with practicing apartheid to please stop doing so. You are damaging the truth. You are damaging any chance for peace in the Middle East. And most of all, you are destroying the memory of the real apartheid. The charge that Israel is an apartheid state is a lie about the real Israel and it is a lie about the real apartheid. I am Kenneth Mishwe, a member of the South African Parliament for Prager University.
In my many years in Washington, the most alarming development has been advertised under the soothing title of campaign finance reform. We Americans are disposed to think that the word reform is a synonym for improvement. But what is called campaign finance reform is nothing less than a frontal assault on the first, the most fundamental of our freedoms, the freedom to speak our minds and to participate in politics. This assault is always conducted stealthily by people who pretend that they only want to regulate money, not speech. They say they are only concerned about the quantity of money in politics. After the 2012 Romney and Obama campaigns spent combined $2 billion, the usual cry was heard from reformers. They said there is too much money in politics. Forget the fact that Americans spend $2 billion every spring just on Easter candy. But you must remember this. People who say there is too much money in politics are necessarily saying three very sinister things. First, they are saying there is too much political speech. Second, they are saying that they know just the right amount of political speech. And third, they are saying that government should enforce the limits they want on the amount of political speech. That is, the government should regulate speech about the government. Over the last few decades, reformers have chipped away at the First Amendment guarantee of free speech. They've done it with various and sundry campaign finance laws, such as limiting the amount of money an individual can give to a candidate. But they're no longer satisfied with merely chipping away at the First Amendment. Now they want to take a sledgehammer to it. They admit that what they want to restrict free speech is incompatible with the Constitution. So, for the first time in American history, reformers calling themselves progressives are proposing to change the First Amendment in order to empower Congress to decide the quantity, content, and timing of political speech. And who would benefit from the speech-restricting rules Congress would write? Well, we know this. Every campaign finance law that ever has existed or ever will exist has been or will be written by incumbent legislators. That is, all laws regulating campaigns will favor the re-election of incumbents. Incumbents have enormous electoral advantages stemming from their perquisites of office, name recognition, a catalog of favors done for constituents, and so on. Hence, incumbents generally do not need to spend as much money as their challengers must spend. Hence, incumbents write laws making fundraising more difficult. Those who advocate restricting how much money we can contribute to candidates or how much money candidates can spend on campaigns always say the same thing. They say, we are only restricting money, and money is not speech. To see how silly this distinction is, consider the following. The New York Times constantly says that money is not speech, and therefore the spending of money can be restricted without restricting freedom of speech. But suppose conservatives controlled Congress and said to the New York Times, we, of course, would never restrict the freedom of the Times to practice journalism, heaven forbid. We are only going to restrict the amount of money the Times can spend on gathering the news and distributing its newspapers, the amount it can spend on journalists, paper, ink, printing presses, delivery trucks, advertisements, and so on. Do you think the New York Times would be content with this? Would the Times say, that's fine, because you are only regulating our right to spend money, not our right to speak? No. The Times would strenuously object. It would say, money is indispensable for making our speech effective. That is true, and not just for the Times. Without ample money, no congressional candidate can speak to an entire congressional district. And no Senate candidate can communicate to an entire state. And no presidential candidate can make his or her case to our continental nation. Contributing to candidates is one of the most common forms of political participation. So, restricting campaign contributions reduces participation. The only constitutional way to reduce the amount of money invested in politics is to reduce the role of politics in the distribution of money. If government were not so big, if it were not so busy allocating wealth and opportunity to the politically well-connected, then politics would be less important in our lives and less money would be spent on it. So, the next time someone says we should make government even bigger by giving it the power to regulate speech, tell that person that what we really need is more speech advocating less government. I'm George Will for Prager University.
Women in the United States and in Western Europe are the freest and most liberated in human history. In many ways, they are not merely doing as well as men, they are doing better. Women's emancipation is one of the glories of Western civilization and one of the great chapters in the history of freedom. So why, then, are those in the women's movement, such as the leaders and members of activist groups like the National Organization for Women, the professors in women's studies departments at our colleges, and many women in the media, why are they still so dissatisfied? These feminists hardly acknowledge women's progress. Yes, they concede that some advances have been made, but the fact that most women reject their activist brand of feminism and think of themselves as free is, for this crowd, proof of just how entrenched patriarchy and inequality truly are. Women are so oppressed, they don't even know it. Year after year, these activists make claims about women in violence, women in depression, women in eating disorders, women in workplace injustice, to support their views. Over the years, I have looked carefully at many of these claims, and what I have found is that much of the supporting evidence, mostly victim statistics, is misleading and often flat out wrong. Consider the issue of the so-called gender wage gap. How many times have you heard that for the same work, women receive 77 cents for every dollar a man earns? This charge is constantly repeated by feminist activists and their supporters. Yet it is so deeply misleading as to border on outright falsehood. 23-cent gender pay gap is simply the difference between the average earnings of all men and women working full-time. It does not take account for differences in occupations, positions, education, job tenure, or hours worked per week. Now, wage gap activists and groups like the American Association of University Women or the National Women's Law Center, they say, no, no, even when you control for these factors, women still earn less. Well, it always turns out that they have omitted one or two crucial data points. Take the case of doctors. On the surface, it looks like female physicians are clearly victims of wage discrimination. They appear to earn less for the same work. But dig a little deeper beneath the surface, and you find that women are far more likely than men to enter lower-paying specialties like pediatrics or family medicine than higher-paying cardiology or anesthesiology. They are also more likely to work part-time. And even women who work full-time put in about 7% fewer hours than men. Women physicians are also far more likely to take long leaves of absence, usually to start a family. Now, there are exceptions, but most workplace pay gaps narrow to the point of vanishing when one accounts for all of these relevant factors. Now, how do the women's advocacy groups react to this? They insist that women's choices are not truly free. Women who decide, say, to stay home with children or to work fewer hours or to become pediatricians rather than heart surgeons are held back by invisible barriers or internalized oppression. According to the National Organization for Women, powerful sexist stereotypes steer women and men toward different educational training and career paths and family roles. But is it really social conditioning that explains women's vocational preferences and their special attachment to children? Perhaps in the pursuit of happiness, men and women take somewhat different paths. And isn't it more than a little patronizing to suggest that most American women are not free, they're not self-determining human beings? And here is common sense proof that the male-female wage gap is untrue. If it were really true that an employer could get away with paying Jill less than Jack for the exact same work, wouldn't most employers fire as many of their male employees as possible and replace them with females and enjoy a huge market advantage? As a regular campus lecturer, I routinely encounter students who have fully accepted the feminist propaganda. American college women are arguably the most fortunate, liberated beings on the planet, yet in their feminist theory classes, they're likely to learn that they are put upon and tyrannized by men. And the more elite the school, the more advanced the degree, the more likely they are to take such feminist propaganda seriously. But this doesn't have to continue. The time has come for young women to take back feminism, reform it, correct its excesses, repudiate the victim propaganda, get rid of the women are from Venus, men are from hell storylines, and begin the arduous task of correcting almost three decades of feminist misinformation. And women who are plagued by workplace injustice or sexual violence will be best helped by truth and solid research, not by hysteria and hype. And as a final piece of personal advice for young women, appreciate and make good use of the unprecedented freedom that you have. I'm Christina Hoff Summers of the American Enterprise Institute for Prager University.
There are 193 countries in the United Nations today. Of these, one has been singled out as an especially egregious offender of the organization's mandate to preserve and enhance human freedom and tolerance. Can you guess which it is? It has about 7 million citizens, of whom a fifth are Arab. The government is vibrantly democratic, its press wide open, and religious freedom fully respected. Women have equal rights and gays live openly. The answer is Israel. Here are some facts. 38% of all the resolutions of the United Nations Human Rights Council, the UN's top human rights body, that are critical of specific countries have been directed at Israel alone. The Council has a permanent agenda that governs every regular session. This agenda is composed of 10 items, one of which is always reserved for criticizing Israel. Between 2006, when the Council was created, and 2012, it published 48 reports condemning Israel. During that same period, there were 9 reports on Syria's mass killings and torture of its own citizens, 3 on Iran's genocide-threatening regime, and not one on, for example, China, which denies more than a billion people elementary freedoms. I could go on, but I think you get the idea. So we are faced with a choice. Either there's something very wrong with Israel that I'm not telling you about, or there's something very wrong with the United Nations that you should know about. Let's look into the history of both. First, Israel. Ever since its establishment, voted for by the United Nations, by the way, in 1948, Israel has had to fight its neighbors solely in order to survive. It has endured innumerable acts of terrorism, the most intense from 2000 to 2005, the so-called Second Intifada, in which children and other innocents were blown up in places like pizza parlors and buses and at weddings. It still suffers from rocket attacks against civilians from the Gaza Strip, which is controlled by a terror group, Hamas, whose stated reason for existence is to destroy Israel. Israel has developed a strong military and a web of security fences and walls to protect itself. Do these security measures cause hardships to people who must deal with this network? Yes, they do. Israel would like nothing better than to tear all these fences and walls down. but bitter experience informs it as to what would happen if it did. Is Israel a perfect country? Of course not. But it is one of the freest and most open societies in the world. That's Israel's history. Here's the UN's. In 1949, when the UN admitted Israel as a member state, the UN had 58 member countries and a clear democratic and pro-Western orientation. Today, the UN has 193 member countries, most of which are not even free. Among its many negative changes, the UN changed the principle of self-determination from a post-World War II, post-Holocaust human rights principle to a tool to wield against the West, especially against Israel. This reached its fullest expression at the notorious Durban Conference, held in South Africa in 2001. The Durban Conference was billed as a UN world conference against racism and intolerance, but it turned into an orgy of anti-Israel and anti-Jew propaganda. Of all the bad actors in the world, the final Durban Declaration found one state guilty of racial discrimination. You guessed it, Israel. The Durban Declaration, however, remains to this day the centerpiece of the UN's allegedly anti-racism agenda. There's only one country in the world whose very legitimacy is questioned. Only one country that is openly threatened with annihilation. That country is Israel. And what has the United Nations done about it? Worse than nothing. It has itself become a global platform for anti-Semitism and the destruction of the Jewish state. I'm Ann Bayefsky, director of the Touro Human Rights Institute for Prager University.
Is higher education politically liberal? The answer is clearly yes. In virtually every field within academia, the great majority of professors identify strongly with both leftist causes and the Democratic Party. Renowned sociologist Seymour Lipset was one of the first to examine this question. Based on a number of surveys taken since World War II, Lipset concluded that academics are more likely than any other occupational group to identify their views as left or liberal. Professors tend to support a wide variety of egalitarian social and economic policies. They're far more likely to vote for Democratic candidates, and in many cases back leftist third parties. While Lipset based his conclusions on faculty surveys from the 1950s through the early 1980s, more recent studies show that the professoriate's commitment to leftist politics has only strengthened. In our book, The Still Divided Academy, my colleagues April Kelly Westner, the late Stanley Rothman, and I take an in-depth look at faculty views at the beginning of this century. Consistent with earlier studies, we find that a mere 12% of professors see themselves as Republicans. But even this statistic is deceiving. Among the small minority of faculty who call themselves Republicans, 51% are pro-choice, 63% support more environmental regulations, even though it could cost people their jobs, and 39% of Republicans believe that the government should work to reduce the income gap between the rich and the poor. So not only are there relatively few Republicans in the ranks of the faculty, but many of the Republican professors hold views that are identical to Democrats outside of academia. Based on the best evidence, fewer than 1 in 10 professors hold conservative social, political, moral, or economic views. Although college professors are overwhelmingly on the left, there are big differences in the political values of faculty depending on their field. Dan Klein, a professor of economics at George Mason University, and his colleagues conducted an in-depth study of 6 academic disciplines: anthropology, economics, history, philosophy, political science, and sociology. Within these fields, faculty back the Democratic candidate over Republican candidates by a ratio of 15 to 1. The left's advantage was most lopsided in anthropology and sociology, where Democratic faculty voters outnumbered Republican voters by approximately 30 to 1. In political science, faculty support for the Democrats over Republicans runs only 7 to 1. And in economics, the ratio is a mere 3 to 1. On the surface, then, it certainly appears that the odds are stacked against college students receiving anything but a left-wing indoctrination. But the picture is not so grim as it might first appear. In the battle for ideas, conservative professors don't need to be equally represented in a discipline.
to have an impact on the students they teach. Whereas sociology or philosophy students may never hear a conservative perspective. Most economics and political science departments have at least one, and often more than one Republican on the roster. Even in leftist academia, there are islands of non-leftist thought, provided students who do not want to receive only one view of the world know where to look. Given academia's overwhelmingly left-wing bias, what effect does this have on the students' thinking? The evidence is somewhat surprising. According to my research, students who enter conservative tend to remain conservative, and students who enter liberal tend to remain liberal. Conservative students, if they look for conservative professors, can often find some. And liberal students can easily go through 4 or more years at the university having never heard a conservative idea. Ironically, therefore, it's not conservative students who suffer as a result of this overwhelmingly liberal bias, but liberal students. They rarely, if ever, have their views challenged. And if the point of college is to expose students to diverse worldviews, then college experience for liberal students is sadly lacking. And what about students who enter college without any formed ideology? They're also shortchanged by higher education's liberal bias. These students are pushed toward a left-leaning worldview in large part because that's the only perspective they've ever been offered. Ideally, higher education should be about expanding students' minds by subjecting them to new ideas and testing their assumptions. That's exactly what most conservative students experience, and that's exactly what most liberal students don't. And that's a shame. I'm Matthew Wessner, Associate Professor of Political Science at Penn State University Harrisburg for Prager University.
Shortly after taking office, President Barack Obama's Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, acknowledged that America's public school system is broken. "It's obvious the system's broken," he said. "Let's admit it's broken. Let's admit it's dysfunctional. Let's do something dramatically different, and let's do it now. Let's fix the thing." Why are America's public schools failing? Why, after more than a quarter century of perpetual reform, has the nation been unable to bring real change to public education? Well, a complete answer, of course, would be very complicated. But at the heart of it lies the power of the teachers' unions, the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, and their state and local affiliates. Now, I don't say this out of some sort of anti-union ideology. I say it as an objective description of reality, backed by an enormous amount of data. Union power has created insurmountable problems for effective schools. Why has this happened? Partly, it's because the teachers' unions are by far the most powerful groups in American education. More than that, they're special interest groups, which means that they use their power to promote the special interests, the job interests, of their members. They're just not in the business of representing the interests of children, and no one should expect them to do that. The purpose of a union is to represent the job interests of its members, and these interests are simply not the same as the interests of children. So how, then, do they pursue these job interests? Well, they do it in two ways. The first is through collective bargaining, which takes place in local school districts. Through collective bargaining, the unions are able to win countless restrictive work rules written into binding contracts that specify how the schools must be organized. Typically, for example, these contracts include salary rules requiring that teachers be paid entirely on the basis of seniority and credentials, without any regard for whether their students are actually learning anything. Often, these contracts also include seniority rules that allow senior teachers to take desirable jobs that come open, even if these teachers are mediocre in the classroom or a bad fit for the school. There are also seniority rules requiring that, in layoff situations, excellent young teachers must be let go automatically, and their senior colleagues must be kept on no matter how incompetent they may be. Labor contracts are just filled with these kinds of perverse rules. No one who's thinking only of what is best for kids would ever organize the schools in this way. Yet this is how America's schools are actually organized. The other way teachers' unions shape the public schools is through the political process, where they simply have far more clout than any other education groups by many orders of magnitude. They have over 4 million members. They are top contributors to political campaigns. They have armies of activists in the electoral trenches. They have lobbying organizations in all 50 states, and much more. They've used this political clout to block or substantially weaken major reforms. For decades, for example, reformers have tried to bring accountability to American education, but the unions have stood in the way. They've opposed using test scores to measure teacher performance. They've opposed performance-based pay. They've even opposed moving bad teachers out of the classroom. As a result, there are rarely any consequences for low performance. No one's pay suffers. No one loses a job. We have accountability systems in which no one is actually held accountable when kids don't learn. The unions have also fiercely opposed the second major reform movement of our time, the movement for school choice, which seeks to give families new options, to empower them to leave bad schools, and to give the regular public schools stronger incentives to improve. Here, too, the unions fight for their members, not for students and their families. In this case, because school choice allows children, and thus money and jobs, to leave the schools where union members teach. Indeed, the unions are so opposed to choice that they fight to defeat it even for the poorest kids trapped in the nation's worst schools. As a result, after decades of reform efforts, only 4% of public school kids are in charter schools, and less than 1% receive government-funded scholarships for private schools. But here's what it comes down to. The teachers' unions have used their power from the bottom up through collective bargaining to burden the schools with organizations that are literally not designed to be effective. And they've used their power from the top down through politics to stand in the way of accountability, choice, and other major reform efforts. As Arne Duncan well expressed, the nation is fully aware that it has a problem with its public schools. But the main reason that problem persists is that there's another problem, a more fundamental one, that prevents real change and improvement, the problem of union power. Until the nation is able to recognize that problem and do something about it, America's public schools will never be organized to provide kids with the most effective education possible. I'm Terry Moe, professor of political science at Stanford University, for Prager University.
Those who hate the free and democratic state of Israel have dreamed up yet another way to try to destroy it. It has an innocuous name, but not an innocuous purpose. It's called the BDS movement, the initials stand for boycott, divest, and sanction. Created by Palestinian academics, it calls on individuals, on companies, on colleges, churches, cities, and even countries to starve Israel economically and isolate it socially. The ostensible reason for this is Israel's alleged mistreatment of Palestinians living in the areas of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Now, I support the idea of the creation of a Palestinian state. Actually, so do most Israelis. And I'm not particularly supportive of the West Bank settlement policy of the Israeli government. But I condemn the BDS movement in the strongest possible terms. Anyone who has any interest in creating a climate for peace in the Middle East should also condemn the BDS movement, as should anyone who simply understands the immorality of singling out Israel of all the world's countries for economic strangulation. Here's why. First, the BDS movement ignores historical reality. You don't have to delve too deeply into late 20th century history to learn that Israel gained control over the West Bank only after it had been attacked by Jordan in the 1967 Six-Day War. No attack by Jordan, no Israel on the West Bank. It's as simple as that. Furthermore, Israel, on at least two separate occasions, most recently in both 2000 and 2008, has tried to give almost all of the land it acquired in 1967 in the West Bank back to the Palestinians. It's the Palestinians who have rejected each of these offers. In other words, there's no need for the BDS movement, since Israel wants to give the Palestinians their own country. Israel only asks to be able to live in peace in return. Second, the BDS movement ignores current reality. Israel is one of the freest countries in the world, and by far the freest in the Middle East, an area where there's precious little freedom. In a world full of human rights violators of the most blatant kind, why would you want to boycott a country that has a boisterous free press, is a model of women's and gay rights, and whose Arab citizens, one-fifth of the country, are the freest in the Arab world? Let me repeat, the Arab citizens of Israel, who make up one-fifth of Israel's population, are freer than all Arabs living in Arab countries around the world. Now, the common sense principle of human rights is deal with the worst first. By this principle, there should be BDS movements against North Korea, against Syria, against Sudan, or a dozen other countries. Israel wouldn't even make the list. Of course, Israel has flaws, but like all vibrant democracies with regular elections and functioning courts of law, it makes a constant effort to correct them. Let's not forget that Israel did not build a security fence on the border of the West Bank or establish checkpoints because it wanted to keep hard-working Palestinians out of Israel. It did these things because it wanted to keep terrorists out of Israel after enduring years of horrific suicide bombings following the peace talks that the Palestinians rejected in 2000. Third, the BDS movement makes peace much less likely. Why? Because the Palestinians, if they believe that the BDS movement can strangle Israel economically and make it an international pariah, why should they ever negotiate? Why not just wait until Israel has no choice but to capitulate? But the BDS movement doesn't just hurt Israel, it hurts everyone. Israeli scientists and engineers are leading innovators in the fields of medical technology, in the fields of renewable energy, water conservation. The BDS movement wants to keep these scientists, as well as Israeli historians and other academics, from sharing their innovations and their knowledge and their insights with the world, with you. But the BDS activists don't care about helping the world. They care about hurting Israel. This leads to one final issue that has to be confronted, the motives of the people behind the BDS movement. Here, those tempted to support this movement must be very careful. The leaders of the BDS movement have no interest in a two-state solution. They reject the concept of Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people. The BDS movement deliberately fools people. It claims to be opposed only to Israel's settlement policy, when in fact it's opposed to Israel's very existence. You may have sympathy for the Palestinians and wish to help them. I share that sympathy. But by aligning yourself with the BDS movement, you are aligning yourself with people who don't want to see both sides thrive. They want to see one side, Israel, destroyed. They don't merely want to see a change in policy. They want to see an end to the nation state of the Jewish people. Do you want to spend your time and moral energy supporting such a cause? For decent people, the answer is no. I'm Alan Dershowitz, professor of law at Harvard University for Prager University.
How do you respond to people who excel you in invention, creativity, and wealth? Do you envy them? Do you feel their success somehow diminishes you? Or do you admire what they've achieved and try to emulate it? These questions sum up what I call the Israel test. In the 1880s, European Jews settled in Mandate, Palestine, and wrought an agricultural miracle in that desolate territory, then sparsely populated by a few score thousand Jews and a couple hundred thousand Arabs. The Jewish settlers drained malarial swamps, leached salt from the soils, terraced the barren hills, and planted millions of trees. They massively expanded the capacity of the land and enabled it to support a substantial Arab population. In the two decades between 1921 and 1943, Jews quadrupled the number of enterprises, multiplied the number of jobs by a factor of 10, and increased the level of capital investment 100-fold. Far from displacing Arabs, they provided the capital for a major expansion of Arab farms and enabled a sevenfold rise in Arab population by 1948 to a level of 1.35 million, the largest in the long history of Palestine. In other words, the Arabs came to what would soon be the state of Israel because of the Jews. By comparison, Transjordan, now known as Jordan, with the same geological endowment and four times the land, but no Jews, was able to sustain a population density only one-tenth of the population density of Palestine. Crucial to Israel's accomplishments were world-leading technological advances in the recovery of water through desalinization, drip irrigation, and sewage recycling. Over the past 50 years, Israel has increased its population tenfold, its agricultural production 16-fold, and its industrial production 50-fold, while actually reducing net water consumption by 10% since 1948. This huge expansion of effective water resources enabled the land to support not only more Jews, but also millions more Arabs. Today, the state of Israel, with its astonishing achievements in computer science and other high-tech fields, distills both the genius of the Jews and the misdirected anger of the failed states that surround her. The great divide in the Middle East is not between Arab and Jew, but between admiration of achievement, along with the desire to replicate it, and envy, accompanied by violent resentment. People who admire success, who pass the Israel test, tend to be wealthy and peaceful. People who resent achievement, who fail the Israel test, tend to become poor and violent. So again, how do you respond to people who excel you in invention, creativity, and wealth? Do you envy them? Do you feel their success somehow diminishes you? Or do you admire what they've achieved and try to emulate it? The Israel test is the central divide in the world today. How you answer it as an individual, and ultimately how we answer it as a nation, is a test of our own will to triumph over enemies who hate us, as they hate Israel, for what is best within us. I'm George Gilder, a non-Jew who has passed the Israel test, for Prager University.
Being a normal boy is a serious liability in today's classroom. Boys tend to be disorganized and restless. Some have even been known to be noisy and hard to manage. Sound like any boy you know? But increasingly, our schools have little patience for what only a couple of decades ago would have been described as boyishness. As psychologist Michael Thompson has aptly observed, girls' behavior is the gold standard in schools. Boys are treated like defective girls. Now, as a result, these defective girls are not faring well academically. Compared with girls, boys earn lower grades, they win fewer honors, they're far less likely to go to college. Boys are languishing academically while girls are prospering. In an ever more knowledge-based economy, this is not a recipe for a successful society. We need to start thinking about how we can make our grade school classrooms more boy-friendly. Well, here are four reforms that would make a very good start. One, turn boys into readers. In all age groups, across all ethnic lines, boys score lower than girls on national reading tests. Good reading skills, need I say, are critical to academic and workplace success. A major study in the UK discovered, not surprisingly, that girls prefer fiction, magazines, and poetry, while boys prefer comics and nonfiction. Boys whose eyes glaze over if forced to read Little House on the Prairie may be riveted by the Guinness Book of Records.
Cool.
Boys will read if given materials that interest them. If you're looking for suggestions for books that have proved irresistible to boys, go to guysread.com. Two, inspire the male imagination. Celebrated writing instructor Ralph Fletcher contends that too many teachers take what is called the confessional poet as the classroom ideal. Personal narratives full of emotions and self-disclosure, these are stories girls commonly write, and these are prized, whereas action stories describing, say, a skateboard competition or a monster devouring a city, these are not. I recently read about a third grader in Southern California named Justin, who loved science fiction, pirates, and battles. Well, an alarmed teacher summoned his parents to school to discuss the picture the 8-year-old had drawn of a sword fight, which included several decapitated heads. The teacher expressed grave concern about Justin's values. The boy's father was astonished, not by his son's drawing, which to him was typical boy stuff, but by the teacher's overwrought and female-centered reaction. If boys are constantly subject to disapproval for their interests and enthusiasms, they're likely to become disengaged and lag further behind. Our schools need to work with, not against, the kinetic imaginations of boys. Three, zero out, zero tolerance. Boys are nearly five times as likely to be expelled from preschool as girls. And in grades K through 12, boys account for nearly 70% of suspensions. Now, this is often for minor acts of insubordination and sometimes for entirely innocent behavior. Hardly a week goes by without a news story about a young boy running afoul of a school's zero-tolerance policy. Josh Welsh, age 7, was recently sent home from his Maryland school for nibbling off the corners of a strawberry Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun. Josh, like many other boys punished for violating zero-tolerance policies, was guilty of nothing more than being a typical 7-year-old boy. 4. Bring back recess. Believe it or not, recess may soon be a thing of the past. According to research summarized by the Science Daily, since the 1970s, school children have lost close to 50% of their unstructured outdoor playtime. And much less games have vanished from schoolyards. In schools throughout the country, games like dodgeball, Red Rover, even tag have all but disappeared. Too damaging to self-esteem or too violent being the usual excuse. One popular classroom guide suggests tug of war be replaced with tug of peace. Boys need to work off their energy. They need to be free to play games they enjoy. And keeping them cooped up and inside all day will not help them learn. As our schools become more feeling-centered, more competition-free, more sedentary, they move further away from the needs of boys. We need to reverse the boy-averse trends. Male underachievement is everyone's concern. These are our sons. These are the young men with whom our daughters will build a future. If boys are in trouble, so are we all. I'm Christina Hoff Summers, the American Enterprise Institute for Prager University.
Why are so many people with so many different perspectives, from the Prime Minister of Israel to the King of Saudi Arabia, so worried that Iran might build a deliverable nuclear weapon? Or, to put it even more simply, why do we have to stop Iran from getting the bomb? The reason is painfully obvious. They might actually use it. France has nuclear weapons. So does the United Kingdom. But nobody worries that they will use them. It's not nuclear weapons that are the problem. It's who has them and what they might do with them. We do not worship Iran, we worship Allah, said Iranian leader Ayatollah Khomeini in 1980. I say, let this land burn. I say, let this land go up in smoke, provided Islam remains triumphant in the rest of the world. A militant nation that does not fear its own destruction is a sure threat to its enemies. And that threat is taken to a whole new level if the militant nation arms itself with nuclear weapons. Who are the enemies of the Islamic Republic of Iran? There are three. The first enemy of Iran is the United States of America. A common slogan chanted by Iranians at public rallies is "Death to America." But it's not just a slogan. Iran has been committing actual acts of war against what it calls the Great Satan for over 3 decades. There was Iran's seizure of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979, the 1983 bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut that killed 241 American servicemen, and the 1996 Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia that killed another 19 Americans. Not to mention the war in Iraq, during which Iran did little to disguise the fact that it supplied anti-American militias with sophisticated, armor-piercing munitions responsible for the maiming and death of hundreds of U.S. soldiers. A nuclear Iran could greatly expand its efforts to harm American interests, secure in the knowledge that its possession of nuclear weapons would make any military retaliation extremely unlikely. And over time, and not much time, a nuclear Iran could develop the sort of intercontinental ballistic missiles that would bring American and European cities within range of its weapons. A second enemy of Iran, which is a Shiite Muslim nation, are the Sunni Muslim nations of the Middle East. An Iranian bomb would instantly spark a nuclear arms race in the region, as Arab states, nearly all of which have majority Sunni populations, move to defend themselves against aggression from Iran. As these regimes and dictatorships race to become nuclear powers, the chances that nuclear weapons might be used, either directly or through terrorist proxies, grow exponentially. And the third and ultimate enemy of Iran is Israel. Only around 1,000 miles separate the Islamic Republic from the Jewish state. Iranian leaders have called Israel a rabid dog, a cancerous tumor that needs to be cut away, and have called publicly and repeatedly for Israel's annihilation. They wage a continuous terrorist war against Israel through their proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas. Former Iranian President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, a man often described as a moderate and a pragmatist in the Western press, articulated the Iranian position this way. If one day the Islamic world is also equipped with weapons like those that Israel possesses now, then the imperialist strategy will reach a standstill because the use of even one nuclear bomb inside Israel will destroy everything. However, one bomb will only harm the Islamic world. He's right. That's why the civilized and sensible leaders of the world cannot allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons. Because once the Iranians do, they will pose a severe threat to the security of America and Europe, spark a regional arms race that could see the world's worst players acquire the world's worst weapons, and threaten the Jews with extermination for the second time in a century. Or, to put it more simply, Iran cannot be allowed to get the bomb because they might actually use it. I'm Brett Stevens.
Join Prager University, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and sign up for free at prageru.com.